I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The first 2 months with the Kansas legislature have been rough for Governor Laura Kelly. She's been pushing for more school funding and the expansion of Medicaid, but she's meeting resistance just about every step of the way. Today, a mid-session legislative review, two State House reporters give us their take on the struggles over tax cuts and education and the chances of Medicaid changes passing. Then, growing up black in Portland, Oregon, left one man wondering how he survived. We'll talk with an author whose memoir examines violence, addiction, and masculinity and the influences that have changed the lives of so many disenfranchised Americans. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Laura Kelly may be Kansas's new governor, a Democrat elected over Republican Kris Kobach back in November, but this is March, and after a couple of months of the 2019 session, it's now pretty clear that Republicans have no plans to give her what she wants. And what she wants is more funding for schools, protections for vulnerable kids, and expansion of Medicaid. The partisanship of Washington, D.C. appears to be descending into Topeka. With us to talk about the first weeks of the session are Jim McLean. He covers the legislature for the Kansas News Service. Jim, always good to have you.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
And Stephen Crand is also with us. He's the State House Bureau Chief for Kansas Public Radio. Stephen, good morning.
Hi there.
You know, Stephen, the overall sense from over here is that this session hasn't produced a whole lot. Is that accurate?
Well, that's been the criticism, especially from Democrats, is that they've really only fully approved one single bill. It went to the governor's desk. She signed it last week, and that was a bill to make up for a missed payment in the state pension plan. But Democrats argue, look, on big issues like school funding, they haven't approved any legislation. However, Republican leaders, specifically the House Majority Leader, told me that, you know, these are big issues. It takes time to get solutions, so people shouldn't be panicking that they haven't figured everything out just yet.
How rough a ride, Jim, has Governor Kelly had the first 2 months of this session? What's your sense?
Well, I think you characterized it just right, Steve. I think it has been a pretty rough ride. The question is, I wonder if she expected it. She had served, of course, with these very same people as a member of the Kansas Senate for many years, and she sounded a note of bipartisanship in the campaign and said that was one of her claims to fame, politically speaking, is that she could work on both across the aisle. However, she really, most of the overtures she has attempted to make so far this session have been ignored, and ignored with intent by the Republican leadership. And you mentioned it earlier, Medicaid expansion, school funding. Stephen has been covering the full school funding debate, and we think that the proposal the governor made to finally get funding up to a level that the Kansas Supreme Court deems as appropriate is on its way to the Senate floor. We were just discussing before we came on whether or not we thought the Senate would pass that. But you're right, I think she's gotten a very hostile reception. I'm not sure if she really expected it.
I was going to say, did you expect this, Jim?
Well, you know, I should have, probably. I mean, Susan Weigel, who is the president of the Kansas Senate, is running for that soon-to-be-vacant U.S. Senate seat. So there are a lot of political undertones to this. House Speaker Ron Reichman is said to be interested in the 3rd District congressional seat. So a lot of political posturing. And the Republicans have said out loud, Steve, that they don't consider Governor Laura Kelly, his election to some degree legitimate because she won with less than 50% of the vote because, of course, Greg Orman, the independent, was in the race. She beat Kris Kobach by 4 or 5 percentage points. Nevertheless, they do not believe she was elected with any kind of a mandate.
Stephen Crando, what's your theory here as to why Republicans are standing up to her as, you know, as resolutely as they are?
Well, part of it is they just don't see eye to eye with her on some of the big issues, and that hasn't changed now that she's in the governor's office. Think back to some of the big debates, and these same players and then Senator Laura Kelly also did not agree on big issues in recent years. I will say that there's been kind of a change on Governor Kelly's school funding plan. You know, initially it went nowhere. But then recently, it's actually started advancing. As Jim mentioned, a Senate committee pushed her school funding plan out last week, sending it to the full Senate for debate with mostly Republican votes. It seems like some Republican leaders now may be accepting the $90 million per year that she's proposing because it's based on Kansas State Department of Education numbers. It's not clear what'll happen with the full Senate debate, but that issue actually may be starting to swing back in the governor's favor.
And Stephen, just to be crystal clear here, the state Supreme Court has said the legislature needs to add this money or it'll be out of compliance with what the court is demanding here.
Exactly. They have to do something. The worst case scenario is they don't do anything or they do something the court doesn't agree with and the court threatens to close schools. So far, they've continued giving lawmakers a chance to address it again. But yeah, they have to do something. And now it's starting to look like maybe they're going to do something closer to what the governor proposed.
So ultimately, is this a personality clash with Senate President Susan Wagle or is it a political clash given Susan Wagle's ambitions here? Stephen, what's your take on that?
I think it might be a mix. Even if none of these people were running for higher offices, you don't want to be a conservative Republican leader of the House or the Senate and just be high-fiving with a Democratic governor all the time. That doesn't look great with Republican donors or a lot of Republicans in the state. So some of it is just based on party politics. But to be honest, we're not at the end of the session yet, and the governor does hold a lot of power with her veto pen. So there could be some meeting of the minds later just out of necessity.
Mm-hmm. You know, Jim, Republicans are not only not giving her what she wants, they're going in different directions on some issues. I'm thinking about tax cuts, most specifically, maybe schools. What do they want to do when it comes to cutting taxes?
Well, what they want to do is they have this big tax relief bill that one version passed the Senate, the other version just last week passed the House, and now they have to reconcile those versions. And everybody's expecting that it's headed for a veto when it gets to Governor Kelly. The main component of that bill, I mean, it stems from the tax cut that passed at the national level that Congress passed a few years ago. Kansas, its tax code is essentially operates in concert with the federal tax code. And because of the changes at the federal level, Kansas now has to make some changes to allow certain people who are individual income tax filers to make deductions and so forth. But the main part of that bill was about $140 million worth of tax relief for major corporations so the state doesn't end up taxing their overseas earnings. And again, it's a very high priority for Senate President Susan Wagle, again, being from Wichita and thinking about a campaign for the U.S. Senate. And I would agree with Stephen that I think it's mainly a political clash at this point. However, it's an open question if you look at the results of the recent election, particularly the exit polls. Laura Kelly performed very well in those exit polls, and the bipartisan approach she was hoping to take was endorsed by voters in those exit polls. So you wonder if this stalemate that we're at the present time, about halfway through the session, how that's going to play politically for Republican leaders. Open question as of right now.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, we just went through in Kansas this series of tax cuts involving Governor Sam Brownback, of course, mm-hmm. that were wound up being widely rejected and sort of thrown back in his face. And Jim, here we are doing the same thing again.
Well, Steve, that's exactly what Democrats and some moderate Republicans are saying on the floor of both the House and Senate when this tax bill is being debated, that we're going back essentially to the Brownback philosophy. And, you know, roughly it's a $200 million cost in the first year to the state treasury and over 3 years, roughly $500 million. And that flies in the face very directly of what Laura Kelly wants to do in terms of kind of bringing state government back from the budget cuts we've seen in recent years, as you mentioned in the open, providing more money for social workers, et cetera, at the Department of Children and Families to fix that very, very troubled foster care system, getting the state highway plan back on track, doing what needs to be done to make state prisons more stable and safe. Governor Kelly claims there's an awful lot of work to be done in that regard, and she says passing this tax bill because of its cost would essentially hinder all of that work. And so that's the crux of the conflict right now.
Well, Steve, Republicans are arguing that some of this is money we otherwise might not collect because of the changes at the federal level. So Senate President Susan Weigel says in response to that, look, the federal tax changes are triggering changes on the state that are going to increase taxes on some businesses and people who used to be able to itemize on their state taxes. So for a lot of it, Republicans are arguing we're not cutting taxes per se. We're going to say we're not going to collect this money we otherwise would.
Yeah, that's exactly that. It's a rhetorical point, but it's also very much on point in the sense that major corporations that have some business operations in Kansas will pay higher taxes if the state does not pass this bill, as will a relatively small percentage of income tax filers in the state. Mm-hmm. It would be an unintended tax increase on them.
Stephen, do we expect this tax cut bill to wind up on her desk?
We expect it to in some form. Later today, we're going to find out what that form might be, because as Jim hinted, the Senate passed a quote-unquote clean bill, which just dealt with the response to the federal tax changes. However, the House sprinkled in a few other sweeteners, mm-hmm. a cut to the food sales tax, and increasing collection of internet sales taxes to help offset some of the other costs. So now we have these two different versions of the bill. There's a good chance the Senate could just say, okay, House, we like your changes, agree and send it to the governor, or they could call for a conference committee. Then we'll get a little negotiation back and forth before they have a final product that the chambers vote on before sending to the governor.
Well, Stephen, a cut in the food sales tax has been a long-standing priority of Democrats. Would Governor Kelly be hard-pressed to veto something like that?
Some of the people, I think one lawmaker put it that this was all about hate for the governor. Some people think that they're adding in these sweeteners basically as kind of a political dare for the governor. They'll send her a bill and say, if you veto this, look, you're vetoing a cut in the food sales tax. You're vetoing collecting more internet sales taxes, which a lot of people want to do. In some ways, it's about getting people to support the bill, but also to create new avenues to criticize the governor should she veto it and put more pressure on her to just agree to it.
Yeah, and Steve, I should point out that, of course, Kansas has one of the highest sales taxes on food in the country. It's 6.5%. What they put in this bill would trim it only by a penny on the dollar, down to 5.5%. So it's a modest decrease. And Governor Kelly is on the record as saying she very much wants to cut the sales tax on food, but not right now, given the other priorities. She doesn't think the state can afford it. And I think she would like to do a lot more than cut it by a single percentage point.
Well, it's so popular, but the question is this the way to do it?
Right.
So much for bipartisanship, then. That's the platform that Governor Kelly ran on. I'm not hearing you guys describe anything that's anything close to bipartisanship.
It doesn't feel that way right now, Steve. I'll tell you, what will be interesting is this tax bill goes to the governor pretty much intact. And if she vetoes it, as many people expect, a lot of moderate Republicans don't like this tax bill very much and secretly agree with the governor in terms of the need to keep state revenues flowing in to take care of some of these other problems. But, you know, the first round, they're not going to vote against a tax cut, and they didn't. And so this bill got pretty widespread support among Republicans of all rank and ideology. But it will be interesting to see, as Stephen said, down the road, when other things are hinging, when deals are to be made on Medicaid expansion, school funding, and a host of other things, where the compromise point on this bill will be. The one thing to watch here, Steve, is if indeed Kelly vetoes that tax bill, whether or not she has the votes to sustain that veto. And it looks, just based on the initial votes in both the House and Senate, that she has those votes, but just barely.
And we could be in a situation where in a month or two, we're looking at a situation where the governor would maybe say, okay, I'll give you this out of the tax bill if you give me this Medicaid expansion or something else.
I can only imagine how frustrated she is. Has she said anything, Stephen, about how frustrated she is?
Kelly is a cool character in these situations. So she, at her press events, she won't say whether she'll veto the tax bill. She doesn't act frustrated. She has now admitted that she doesn't expect her pension plan reamortization to move forward. But as she puts it, you know, we can look at this in the coming years. Kelly is not putting out a public persona of panicking. She's not telling the public to put pressure on Republican leaders on some of these big issues. Mm-hmm. She's right now sitting back and kind of just waiting and seeing, it looks like.
Yeah, Stephen, it does make me think that maybe she really did anticipate that there would be some rough going initially, because as Stephen says, she has not she hasn't really thrown down the gauntlet and taken these Republican leaders on. She keeps sounding this bipartisan message and saying, hey, be patient. We're only halfway through the session. There's a lot of time left. And so that's literally the public persona that she's projecting at this point.
Okay, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking about the Kansas legislature at about the midpoint of the 2019 session. We're joined by Jim McLean with the Kansas News Service, Stephen Caranda, the State House Bureau Chief for Kansas Public Radio. Let's move over to Medicaid expansion, another issue that at least the polls suggest has broad support. Where do we stand on that issue, Jim?
Well, it's really impossible to say right now, Steve. I mean, you know, as you say, the polls suggest, and they have for years, that the public, generally speaking, supports Medicaid expansion. Governor Kelly, of course, does and campaigned on it. The Republican leadership in both the House and Senate is still very much opposed to it. So right now, Governor Kelly has introduced an expansion bill, and there has been no hearing on that bill. Last week, we had 3 days of very general discussion about expansion, so-called roundtables in the House Health Committee. But no plan to hold a hearing on the governor's bill, no plan to have a vote on Medicaid expansion. The governor says there are other ways to get an expansion bill on the floor, and she says she's still confident she can get it done. And everybody speculates that the votes are there in both the House and Senate to pass an expansion bill. The trick will be getting it on the floor.
You know, given that, though, Stephen, I've been surprised when I talk to lawmakers about this issue. I've been surprised at how pessimistic some of them are about the chances of passage this year. What's that pessimism based on?
Well, the conservative leaders of the chambers have a lot of power regarding what gets to the floor. If they won't let a Medicaid expansion bill come to the floor for debate, that leaves supporters of it trying to add it on as an amendment or use other procedural maneuvers to pull it into the chamber for debate, and those things are hard to do. So that's one of the reasons that people are being skeptical right now that it'll happen, because if the leaders don't want it, they have a lot of ways to block it.
Okay, if our listeners want to join our conversation, our number here, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. The Kansas Farm Bureau is making a big push to get the authorization to sell these non-insurance health benefit plans to its members. What are those plans, Jim, and what's significant about them?
Well, they're very significant, Steve. It's interesting how this issue is juxtaposed with a Medicaid expansion issue. You have a lot of legislators who say that health insurance has become unaffordable for farmers and ranchers who have to buy insurance in what they call the individual market. They don't have group employee plans that they join. And as such, the Farm Bureau has come forward with what it thinks is a remedy for that. They want to sell what they call health benefit plans. It can't be called health insurance because technically it doesn't meet the definition of insurance, because it would be totally unregulated, exempt from state and federal regulations, including those rules at the federal level that require insurers to offer coverage to all comers. They call it guarantee issue. So if the Farm Bureau gets this authorization, they could underwrite their plans, go back to the old days of insurance and underwrite these plans and deny people coverage who have pre-existing conditions. And that is what has made this so controversial. Hmm. And what the Farm Bureau says is, hey, this would give farmers and ranchers, young, healthy farmers and ranchers in particular, an option, an affordable option they don't now have. So why not do it? They claim that they could offer coverage that would cost about 30% less than insurance coverage on the private and Affordable Care Act marketplaces.
So this is aimed primarily at younger farmers, as you're saying here, Jim, because you get to be my age and everybody's got a pre-existing condition.
Right. The state of Tennessee has coverage like this already in place, has been for years, and the questionnaire that the applicants have to fill out has 76 questions about conditions that you may or may not suffer from. And so, yeah, and that's one of the complaints other people have. Blue Cross Blue Shield of Kansas specifically has this complaint that what will happen here is that a lot of healthy people will be taken out of the marketplace, forcing up the cost of coverage for everybody left in the marketplace who doesn't meet that criteria. And again, this would only be able to be sold to Farm Bureau members. But theoretically, anybody who lives in the state of Kansas can join the Farm Bureau and become a member.
Stephen Caranda, what about protecting vulnerable children? I think Jim has alluded to this as being one of Laura Kelly's priorities for this session. What does the governor want to do, and where does all that stand?
A big part of it for Governor Kelly was hiring more staff in the Department for Children and Families. So we haven't fully seen the budget process yet if that's going to happen. I think that issue has a lot of support. So we could see additional money in the budget for those types of things. But the budget just isn't finished yet, so we don't know at the moment.
You know, all of this, I can't help but think, reminds me of the last time the Democrats had an elected governor newly placed into office back in 2003. That was Governor Kathleen Sebelius. She mm-hmm. didn't get anything out of the legislature for a few years. How similar is what Laura Kelly facing today compared with what Governor Sebelius faced back a few years ago, Jim?
It's interesting, Steve. It feels very similar to
that. Yeah, it does.
And it does. And I think, frankly, Governor Kelly came into office understanding that. As you know, she and Kathleen Sebelius are pretty good friends. In fact, former Governor Sebelius is one of the people who talked Laura Kelly into running for governor and is now back in the state. And I think counsels Governor Kelly fairly regularly. And so I think, frankly, that she did anticipate this maybe at least initially, which again is maybe one of the reasons that she's not sounding the alarm at this point, just trying to stay patient and allowing those coalitions to emerge at the end of the session where maybe she can get some help from moderate Republicans like Governor Sebelius did in the school funding debate of that era, which, you know, essentially is the same place we still are in the state.
Right. Stephen, you know, Governor Kelly, as we've said, has been in office for a couple of months here. How well is her administration operating? Are the people in place, key appointments been made? Where do we stand with all of that?
Well, like with any new governor, she has appointed a bunch of new cabinet secretaries and other staff. There hasn't really been much pushback on her choices so far. But again, it's still early. So a lot of these secretaries haven't, you know, had a lot of time to work on these big issues. So I think we're going to be really watching to see how things develop in the coming months. And maybe next legislative session is when we're really going to start seeing maybe lawmakers filling out report cards on some of the things the agencies are doing in a way. Mm.
I was just curious about how the Republicans turned Democrats are doing this session. I'm thinking of several Johnson County lawmakers,
right.
Stephanie Clayton, Dinah Sykes, and Barbara Beaulieu, all from Johnson County. What's the report card there, Jim?
Well, I think they're fitting into their new caucuses pretty well based on the few caucus meetings that I've attended and watched them interact with their colleagues. I think from an issue standpoint, they're certainly more comfortable now in the Democratic Party. As you know, I did that story initially in the session about the three of them. So I think they're all personally more comfortable. And one of the things, again, is that Senator Sykes got a choice assignment on the Senate Education Committee. So at the end of the session, when that debate matures on school funding, she will be one of the people probably appointed to the conference committee that works out a final deal on that. And as you know, Barbara Beaulieu, the senator from Mission there, Mission Hills, got Governor Kelly's former seat on the Senate Health Committee. And so she's a ranking Democrat on that committee. And that's an influential position there, too. I mean, I haven't heard a lot from them. I know that they're but they have adjusted. And I think, again, from an issue standpoint, they're more comfortable where they are now.
You know, do her former Republican colleagues, do they scorn these lawmakers for having switched? What do you see on that front?
It depends. You talked to Senator John Scoobel then of Overland Park. Now, no big deal. You know, he understands why those switches were made, and he gives them that. But if you talk to some more conservative members of the caucus, I think they do resent it, as a matter of fact.
Maybe just a final point, Stephen Caranda. How would you describe the mood of this legislature? Anything that strikes you about it that's different than any other year, or is it pretty much par for the course?
I think it's really kind of similar to what we've seen in a lot of recent years. The way that the calendar breaks down, if everyone remembers, is they take most of April off, then they come back this year, I believe it's May 1st, for the veto session. Traditionally, that would be to consider overriding vetoes from the governor, but in recent years, that's really become where they do the real work and forge the final agreements. And I think some lawmakers now are just kind of tapping their toes, waiting to see what happens and preparing themselves for long nights and big debates when they come back in May for the final stretch of the session.
And Steve, I think you made a very apt comparison when you were introing this segment, when you said that the politics of Washington, D.C. has settled into Topeka. I see a lot of that. I think there's a lot of evidence of that.
That's interesting. Jim McLean covers the legislature for the Kansas News Service. Stephen Caranda is the State House Bureau Chief for Kansas Public Radio. Thank you both, as always, for a good conversation. I appreciate it.
Well, so do we, Steve. Thanks.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk with Mitchell Jackson about his new book, Survival Math, Notes on an All-American Family, that examines his tumultuous youth in Portland, Oregon. That's after a short break here. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. On Friday, the Kansas City Star recently offered another round of buyouts. We talked with three journalists about their decision to accept that offer. Hear that in other conversations at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, we wrap up our series with Kansas City mayoral candidates. Quentin Lucas joins us to discuss his plans on crime, affordable housing, and development. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, Mitchell Jackson puzzles over some big questions in his new book, Survival Math, Notes on an All-American Family, that examines his tough youth in Portland, Oregon. One of the questions he asks simply is, why is he still alive? Near certain death was right at hand any number of times. Another question, what stopped him from killing someone else? Mitchell Powell struggles with those questions and the meaning of family and masculinity and the impact of substance abuse and addiction. He makes one thing clear, there's no room for pity. Mitchell Jackson is also the author of The Residue Years, a novel. He's a clinical associate professor of writing in liberal studies at New York University, and he joins us this morning from Oregon Public Broadcasting out in Portland. Mitchell, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Good morning, and how is it for you being back in Portland? I can't help but wonder.
Oh, it's amazing to be home. Well, first of all, the weather is great here. It's a sunny day, and we don't often get that in the springtime, so I'm going to take that as a sign that I'm supposed to be here today.
Is it comfortable for you there, or is it a place that, in your mind, maybe you'd left behind a long time ago and maybe never wanted to see again? Because you read your book, and you sort of wonder.
Yeah, no, I love this place. My family is still here. My siblings, my parents, my grandparent, and I come home probably 5 to 6 times a year, and I could come home less, but I really want to stay connected to my community and the people here.
You know, the Portland you describe in this book is not the Portland that a lot of people here in the heartland might think they know something about. Tell us about your home city.
It's a different city now. I'm writing a lot about my memory of the city. And I'm 43 years old, so I grew up in the late 70s and 80s here. I didn't even know it was a small black community because it was my only community, but it was small. And, we had churches. I remember going to lots of church dinners when I was young and eating in the basement of churches and having a lot of friends that went to school with me. And we would, make go-karts and play basketball and do backflips in the schoolyards. Mm-hmm. And that went on and probably until around the mid to late 80s when, other areas that were depressed across the country, crack cocaine entered the neighborhoods, and then that started to kind of change the way that the neighborhood looked and some of the opportunities that people had that I could kind of see as a child back then. So I was, 10, 11 years old when that happened.
Hey, tell us about the format of this book. You tell this story through the eyes and experiences of many of your relatives, and those are the photographs, the very arresting photographs, by the way, we see in the cover of your book. Tell us what you were trying to do here.
I think the story is kind of born out of two one incident and then one kind of set of questions I was wrestling with. So the survival math came out of an incident that happened to me when I was in my early 20s, I think. I might have been like late teens. And I had a guy threatened to shoot me over a conflict that we had had. And the kind of decision-making that occurred between him threatening me and my response to him is what later on became survival math. So I, will he shoot me? Are there witnesses? Can I shoot him? If I do, am I going to go to jail? How can I get away?
Are you talking about your encounter with Stitches?
Yes, I'm talking about my encounter with Stitches.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So that years later became my idea of survival math. But I was also really concerned with, I was like in the conception phase of this book around the beginning of the Black Lives Matter movement. And one of the things that really struck me is how they were portraying some of the victims as dangerous or looking dangerous or threatening. And so I wanted to figure out a way to challenge that. And that's how I got to wanting to include photographs.
Mm-hmm.
So the men on the cover are all my family members. There's brothers, cousins, uncles, grandfather, nephew. And I ask each of those men the same question. What's the toughest thing that you've survived? And I was really trying to get at their survival stories. But also I wanted to find out about the ways in which they were resilient.
Let's go to some of those big questions that you ask in this book, and let's talk about survival for a moment. In your words, how did you avoid the fate of a hash mark in the city's criminal homicide tally? What was what was the magic sauce that you brought to the table that allowed you to get through it?
So I think it might be a deficit that I had, and I think one of the things is a lack of commitment. And so I never committed fully to the idea of myself as the tough guy, as a gang member, as a drug dealer. But then I also never really fully committed to myself as an intellectual or a student or, you know, a loving person. And so you put those two things together, like I'm not committing in any direction, but I also am very reluctant to make the decisions that I think will make me commit to any one of those kind of identities. And so I think that helped me.
Well, what stopped you from making those commitments? What was it about you that caused you not to go full in one way or the other?
So I think when we talk about like people who have escaped a certain circumstance of oppression, we call them exceptional. And I think in on one hand, I do believe myself to be exceptional because I did, for the most part, escape, you know, some of the pitfalls of that life. But then on the other hand, I don't believe myself to be exceptional. Like I consider myself the equal of my peers. And so I think to be able to hold, which is really what's really a paradox, that you are both exceptional and not exceptional, helps inform your decisions.
That's interesting. Well, late in the book, you describe that encounter that you just talked about with, I guess, an old friend of yours in a sense, this guy named Stitches. First, tell us who he was, because you had something of a history with him.
Yeah, well, he wasn't a friend,
right?
But he was a high school classmate. And we went to the same high school. We had home economics of all courses together. So we were like in there learning how to stitch and, you know, I don't know, cook something. I forgot what you do in home economics, but it seemed like a very unlikely course for us to have together.
But you would laugh together with him over time.
Yeah. Oh, he was actually like a really funny guy, and he had a really unique voice. Like if you were in a crowd and you heard him laugh or say something, you would immediately know that it was him. And so I was close enough to know that about him. And also some of his friends were more of my close friends. But around the time, I guess really it started happening in high school, but right after we graduated high school, he made the full commitment to being a gang member.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, you know, that requires certain kinds of actions, right? So if you say you're a gang member, you've committed to violence. There's no other way around that. And so I don't think that I have heard about in this community or in the, I guess, the old community of anyone who was a more committed and active and violent gang member. And so later on, you know, if he threatens you, then you should not take that as a threat, but take that as something that he's willing to do.
Well, let's talk about these two, we think it's two, terrifying encounters that you had with him. At least you thought this first encounter was with him. You were never really, I think, positive. But one morning you're awakened by your girlfriend's daughter who bursts into your room and she's yelling, "Hey, someone's trying to kick in the back door."
Yeah.
And you're, what happened next?
Well, I went downstairs to see if that was the case, and it was. And this is also around the time that I was halfway committed to being a drug dealer, and so I had a gun, or I thought I did, but I could not
couldn't find it. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is also maybe another blessing for me, because I probably, I mean, I'm sure I would have shot through the door, and who knows what would have happened after that. But I couldn't find it. And then my neighbor, which is really interesting to me, I think there's maybe even a, like, a side when I talk about this in the book where I say, like, white privilege. Like, this guy thought that him screaming out the window that he would call the police on gang members would, like, make them run off. And it actually worked, but I can't imagine thinking that that would work for guys who are trying to commit a home invasion.
Yeah.
But he did, and they left. And
it was a panicked few minutes there. As
oh yeah,
you think it was multiple people standing outside the door trying
right.
to get in, and you're in there scrambling around the house trying to find your gun,
yeah.
and it sounded just horrific.
Yeah, well, you know, that's those are the kind of circumstances that become almost commonplace. At least around that time in my life, there, you know, on any given night, someone could threaten you or, you know, yeah. try to take something from you. So it wasn't really that out of the ordinary.
Right.
But I'm fortunate that they didn't get in the house. I don't know what would have happened if had that been the case.
You know, a second encounter just as chilling but very different. You're leaving mm-hmm. the house of a young woman on the northeast side of town when mm-hmm. from maybe a block or so away, you notice a man riding towards you on a bicycle. He's wearing an mm-hmm. all-black getup of some kind, replete with a black wool cap. Tell us what happened next.
That's a pretty good reading. That sounds
almost,
like me reading
it's
it.
Almost right out of your book, Mitchell.
Yeah.
It's so well written, yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, so this is after the attempted home invasion. And because the neighborhood is so interconnected, I know that, or I believe that it was Stitches and some of his friends that tried to come in the house or break in the house. And so I do see someone from a distance, all black with a skull cap, which is strange to me because this is, you know, we don't have hipsters yet in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
So no one wears a skull cap in the summertime. And also he's black. So he's riding down, and I'm notorious for not being able to find my keys. And I couldn't that day. And so I'm standing at my car door, patting my pockets for my keys when I finally realize who it is, and it's Stitches. And yeah, he jumps off the bike and threatens me.
He is right. He's arm's length away. He's right there.
Yes. Yes. And you know, it was a day much like today in Oregon, very sunny, except it was warmer because it was like July. And I had already heard several stories about Stitches. I had seen him at different parties. I knew we had mutual friends, mutual acquaintances. So there was very little doubt in my mind that he was what he said he was, and that was a killer. And I didn't want to die, so I had to figure out how to manage that situation.
How did you manage it? Because that situation could have gone south so easily.
Well, I didn't escalate my voice.
Right, right.
You
didn't make eye contact. You looked away.
I looked away. I don't know if I looked away immediately, though, because mm-hmm. I think I needed him to see that I wasn't going to be a threat in that moment. And I actually didn't know whether or not I was going to do something later in that particular moment. But
you had a loaded gun inside
any
movements. The car.
Yeah, I didn't, you know, I didn't put my hands, you know, any quick movements with my hands. Like, I didn't want him to shoot me because he thought that I was going to do something that I was not doing. And then, you know, try to de-escalate as much as I could. And then once he had rolled off, then there was a decision-making process of whether or not to ride. I mean, he was on a bike, and I found my keys eventually, so I could have found him. But that just wasn't something I was willing to commit to.
Hmm. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. I'm visiting with author Mitchell Jackson about his new book, Survival Math, Notes on an All-American Family. You know, the other question you ask in here is why you didn't kill. Turns out you might have come close after you learned that a white kid had stolen a TV and a gun from your house. I wasn't sure if that had happened to you or one of your relatives,
Yes. So, no, that's not me. Those are the survival files. Okay. So the second person stories in the book are the stories
survivals.
Of men on the cover.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
So tell us about that story and why your relative didn't kill.
I guess in some rare cases, there are like psychopaths, you know, serial killers, people who have no moral compass at all. But I don't know any of those people in my life and not my family. And so in that case, no one wants to do it. I mean, the circumstances compel you to make decisions you don't want to make. And I think that's a really clear case that he... You know, there's a moment where I say half your hardened heart and then half your softened heart. And so he is heartful, not heartless. Mm-hmm. And a heartful person does not want to be in a situation where they have to take a life.
Why didn't you kill? Is that the explanation that you have for yourself?
Yeah, that's a part of it. I mean, I think I'm humane. I value life. I don't want the repercussions of having morally to deal with having taken a life. And then I'm also smart. Like, I don't want to end up for the rest of my life in prison. So there's it begins with your morals. Like, are you willing to take a life? Like, what would it take for you to think that you had been so wronged that the only recourse was to take someone's life? And then how are you going to live with that after you've committed that act? I mean, I know people who have done that. And I don't know anyone who's murdered someone that doesn't seem to have some moral baggage with them.
Hmm. You also say that you didn't take a life because you never felt the need to rely on what you called an atomic toughness. Interesting phrase, atomic toughness, meaning sort of what you mentioned before, right? Just this idea that you've got to be somebody that maybe you're really not.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's maybe around that same point, I say tensile strength, which is, I think, the toughest steel. And I think you get into a situation where you believe that this is a way to comport yourself. You believe that the culture is going to value this in some way. And once you kind of halfway commit to it, sometimes it feels inexorable, like it's the only decision that you can make. And then the world kind of reports back on your previous deeds. Mm-hmm. You know, you get friends who do the same thing, and then it makes it like, you know, if not a community, like at least a kind of small clique of people who are steeped in the same values.
Mm-hmm. You know, your mother struggled with addiction. In fact, it ultimately killed her.
No. That's a survival story. She's alive.
She's alive now.
Yes, my mother's alive.
Whose mother struggled with addiction then?
That's the other thing about the survival files is I wanted to give each of those men anonymity as much as I could. So I never identify which story belongs to which person. But one way to kind of catch that it's a survival file is that they're all written in the second person.
Mm-hmm.
And textually in the book, they're also in a different font than the other stories.
Right.
Yeah.
Hey, how did this woman's struggles affect you growing up? What did you notice about that?
Well, I didn't know that particular woman very well, but my mother's addiction, I think the two things that I can think of that were really affecting were this sense that I had to grow up quicker than I would have liked to. I just remember being really young and saying, I'm not watching cartoons anymore. Like, why am I doing this kind of kid stuff when there's like actual problems to be attended to? And then the other thing I think is it planted or seeded in me a kind of mistrust of adults and then of my mother and maybe to a certain degree of women when I was younger that I had to figure out how to overcome.
Let's talk about fathers for a minute. You write this about them in the book. If a boy isn't blessed with a dad or gifted with a dynamic stand-in, he must mm-hmm. find ways to forge one. He must mm-hmm. discern the fatherish men in his life and open himself to their guidance and examples. Hey, how did mm-hmm. that work out for you?
Well, I'm talking to you now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, with the second book and a pretty good job in New York.
Right.
Several men who I can count as models for me. And also, none of those models are without, like, critique in my mind. So I think that it worked out pretty well and that I see them as human beings, but I also see their value. And I was able to kind of compose the kind of model that I needed for myself in any given phase of my life. And so I would say that it worked out pretty well.
But they messed you up when it came to how you regarded women, at least for a long time.
Yes, absolutely. But again, you know, that's part of, those are part of growing, part of, you know, trying to figure out what works and what doesn't, part of having children,
mm-hmm.
Part of falling in love or allowing myself to fall in love. So all of those things help kind of shape you know, the growth of a person. But I do think there was a point in my life where those pathologies were normalized.
Yeah.
And so you have to, I mean, it takes a lot, I think, to get out of something that's been treated as commonplace.
You know, so much of what you describe could be written about life here in Kansas City for so many. I'm wondering, what would have helped? What should we be thinking about here in a city where violence has been out of control for a very long time?
Well, I mean, the general answer would be to create opportunities for people
mm-hmm.
who are historically disenfranchised, oppressed, and to really commit to those. I can think of probably nothing more influential than like giving them educational opportunities, you know. But I think along with like providing education, you also got to make sure kids aren't hungry. You know, they have transportation to school,
right?
That there's aftercare for them. But I mean, you know, education is one way. But then, you know, I'm now at a point where I also recognize like how elite institutions also kind of facilitate like a class system that marginalizes people, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
you know in eighth grade whether or not you're going to an Ivy League school pretty much, and sometimes that's because you had the best tutors, or you went to the school that was funded well, or you went to a private school, and they're a feeder school for these institutions. So we would really have to look at the whole education system, not just say, like, let's give, you know, the Head Start program some extra funding.
So it's jobs, it's education, it's social services, it's the whole ball of wax, you're saying.
Yeah. I mean, this country is built on the class system that we have.
I've got like 20 seconds
that they
left.
Want.
Yeah, go ahead.
So, I mean, I don't know what it would take, but it would be revolutionary, whatever it takes, to kind of dismantle that.
Huh. Mitchell Jackson, an author, Survival Math is his new book, Survival Math, Notes on an All-American Family. Hey, thanks for taking some time, and enjoy your time back out at home in Portland, Mitchell.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
On Friday, I had a great conversation with John McEwen of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. You can hear that in other previous episodes. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, we conclude our series of conversations with candidates for Kansas City Mayor. Councilman Quentin Lucas will join us to discuss his candidacy. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date. Thank you.